something of an overachiever, would you think? I don't know, we'll find out. When he takes up acting, it's not to do panto in the village hall. He's soon on the West End stage. When he's into athletics, of course he's representing Great Britain. And when he gets into community work, well, he ends up advising the government. But there is one thread that runs through all of his story, through the good times and the bad, and that's his faith in Jesus, and we'll be hearing about that as well. I can promise you we're in for a fascinating evening, so please will you welcome Limbert Spencer, OBE. Limbert, thank you.
Hello.
So Limbert has dared to come south of the river from Bedford, but you said it was a bit of a shocking journey for you.
Oh, well, they're very challenging, very challenging. I grew up in North London and, you know, the north-south divide, we mean the Thames.
Yeah. But you're here, thank you very much. Brought up in London, but born in 1948 in Jamaica. Do you have any memories of Jamaica when you were a young child?
Yes, I do. I do have one of my biggest memories of a hurricane, actually, just probably a couple of years before I came to England. I seem to remember being under a table whilst things were shaking and flying around. I also remember that we were part of of an open yard, and our houses, you know, or rooms backed onto the yard, you know. So the notion of yard is kind of does resonate quite strongly. Yeah.
But in 1955, at the age of seven, you come to the UK. So really, you are part of the Windrush generation.
Yes, a few years later, but certainly part of that kind of era. We flew, so we didn't come by sea. Although my father had come a few months earlier, as was really the way in which migration worked back in the 50s. One member of the family, usually the male, would come, probably have a job already, and would then save and bring the family over. And because at that stage it was all in answer to the cry from the mother country, as it were, to come and help rebuild after the war.
And what were your first impressions of UK, of London, as a small boy? You arrived here in 1955.
Well, wet and cold. It was November, after all. So November 55, wet and cold. I also, and I did notice one or two grey hairs as I was coming in. So we'll remember that back then there was fog and smog, you know, coal fires and so on. So things were grey and gloomy, and very different from, you know, obviously the heat and glare of the sunshine.
It must have been quite exciting for a small boy then to travel on an aeroplane as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that when we were coming into land, I looked out, I think I said to my mother, you know, what are all those ants? Because there were people that I could see, but obviously had no sense of distance, and that those were people on the ground.
So you go to school in? Were you in Harlesden area?
In Harlesden,
yeah.
Yes.
Go to school there. Were there so many other black kids in the school when you were there?
Definitely not. No, I was the first and only black kid in the school for a number of years. So it was a case of, you know, if I was to get on, then it was about becoming assimilated, really, into what was already there.
Were you teased by the other children for your strange accent or something like that?
There were one or two incidents, I have to confess. I do recall, and I think I remember it accurately, but you never know, passage of time, one young man who had been particularly difficult for me found himself hanging in the cloakroom. I'm never quite sure how he got there, but apparently it was down to me. Only by his lapel, I have to say. Nothing too serious back then. But yes, it was, you know, it was the time of teasing, name-calling, and some difficulties. I do remember my my head teacher at a few years in did suggest that I might have a chip on my shoulder, and I wasn't sufficiently experienced to explain to him issues of discrimination, exclusion, racism, and so on. I think I probably just scowled and went away. Yeah.
But generally, did you find you were able to fit in with most of the kids when you were at your primary school and at secondary school?
Yeah, I think that the key thing for me was being part of the Salvation Army, because unlike many of the other migrants at that time, we just changed branches of the church. So we were members of the Salvation Army
in Kingston. Yeah.
And when we moved, our transfer papers, were very structured, arrived in Harlesden before we did, and we simply transferred from Kingston Central Salvation Army to Harlesden Salvation Army. So there was a very smooth involvement that was very, very helpful when it came to having a sense of belonging. And I suppose that sense of belonging and confidence that gave meant that some of the issues that were being faced in school were perhaps landed less heavily.
But this really was, I mean, long before Race Relations Act, it was the time of sort of no Irish, no blacks, no dogs, and things like that. So, I mean, did that impact on your family, on your father in...
Yeah, I mean, the impact was pretty profound, but I was only really aware of that years later, because I was pretty shielded from that for them. But that was the reality. I mean, you know, the signs were there, which meant that the accommodation that we and other migrants could have was very, very limited. So, of course, there was this coming together in a single house or a group of houses, because there were literally no other rooms, no other places to be available.
So you had a flat, did you?
We had a room. We had a room in a house with a shared bathroom and kitchen and so on, and that was the way we lived, certainly for probably the first 4 or 5 years whilst I was at primary school in Harlesden. You know, we had this one room in 77 Rottesley Road, I seem to remember. You know, obviously things changed as my parents managed to find other accommodation.
What did your parents do for a living?
Well, they both ended up working on the transport. My father worked for British Rail. It was British Rail then, and he worked on the old steam engines. He gloried in the title of leading shed man, which I think meant that he got into the boiler first to clean out the clinker and stuff, which proved to be a bit of a problem in later life when he lost his sight. My mother worked for London Transport, and she worked in the canteen and became, I think, manageress of the canteen out at Wembley Central. And So, yeah, they had good jobs, they worked hard, and there were lots of jobs going in those days, of course.
And it was just you, no siblings?
No, there's just me, yeah, just me. So
properly spoiled?
Properly spoiled, properly spoiled.
So you leave school and you become an accountant, which, sure, apologies to accountants, was very exciting. then, in 1968, this happens. Very quiet, but... Ooh, do you want to stop it for the moment and try and go back to the beginning? It was playing beautifully earlier.
It was, I heard it.
Talk amongst yourselves for a moment. There you go. Right, then. So 1968.
In the late 60s, hippie and flower power styles caught on as it became fashionable to knock imperialism abroad and materialism at home.
They'll be gaga at the go-go when they see me in my toga. My toga made of blonde, brilliant teen, biblical hair. My hair like Jesus wore it, hallelujah, I adore it. Hallelujah, Mary loved the sun. Why don't my mother love me? Blow it, show it, love is going to grow in my hair. Blow it, show it, love.
Paul Nicholas.
There. So, the London production of Hair, original cast production in 1968, including you. How did that happen?
Including me. Well, that's a very interesting story. Well, I think it's interesting. We'll find out. I was just carrying on being doing my trainee cost and works accountancy stuff, and I'd been involved in amateur dramatics. Salvation Army, which I think is a kind of requirement for young people in the Salvation Army. My mic's gone. Hang on. It's not me. It's gone off. Battery's gone, I think.
Right, can we have that mic, please? It's one of those days. Yes.
Okay. I worked with a man called Peter. His name's gone out of my head now. It'll come back. And his brother was a writer, and he'd written a script for a thing called Mickey Dunn. And they were looking for a black Cockney who could sing and box. Equity did not have anybody on their books at that time. Quite surprising to me, I have to say. Anyway, Pete phoned me one night and said, you know, he told me this story. He said, can you come round and read for my brother? And we were always winding each other up, so I just said, yeah, right, and hung up. He called again and said, no, I'm serious. I went round, I read for his brother. His brother said, this looks really interesting. Can you come and audition? I went, I did a formal audition. I got the part. So I had to become a member of British Actors Equity. I took leave from my job. I was working for the car makers, Rolls-Royce, at that time. And I went off and did this piece of television drama as the, you know, a kind of young lead, juvenile lead, I believe they called the part. When it was over, I went back to work. It was just one of those things you do when you take holiday. And after a while, I was asked to go and audition for another piece of work, and I did, and I got that. The company got a bit fed up, and they decided to that Pete and I perhaps ought to leave. So we were asked to leave. They could do that sort of thing back then. And I left, Pete left. After a couple of weeks, Pete was reinstated. I was not. I thought, well, I might as well just give this acting thing a bit of a go. And I think the next thing that came up was an audition for Hair. I also had the opportunity to go and audition for the Royal Shakespeare Company, which I didn't do. I thought Hair sounded much more interesting, although I had no idea what it was about. So that was it.
How did it go down with Salvation Army, you being in Hair? Because it was notorious, but it was certainly hit the headlines, didn't it?
Yes.
So did your Salvation Army people think this was a good thing? Were they all flocking to see you, or were they all tutting?
And I think there was a bit of both, really. There was quite a lot of tutting, and there was quite a lot of people who came to see the show. But I think the most important thing for me, because I was very young, I didn't really know what it was about, that my then mentor, a man called Bill Daniel, was very, very supportive and helped to keep the difficulties away from me, as it were, and helped me during that period, which was quite problematic in many ways. But also, you know, it was a stunning piece of theatre.
Yeah. And then the next thing we find you doing, you're into athletics and you're representing Great Britain in decathlon. Had you been doing athletics all the way through the time you were acting, or what?
I think I was playing golf, actually, when I was acting, as one does, because you've got nothing to do in the daytime if you're in a show. But I was always into sport, and athletics was my favourite sport. I did quite a lot of that. And I wasn't quite sure which events. It was the classic, you know, active in many areas but master of none kind of thing. So the decathlon was virtually ready-made for me, really. I could have a go at everything. Those of us who did the decathlon, we were loved by our clubs because they would just ask us to fill in. Except the steeplechase. I really wasn't interested in doing the steeplechase. But that was an interesting
what
time.
What was your best discipline at the decathlon?
I was a sprinter jumper, so high jump, long jump, high hurdles really was a good one. I was, as decathletes go, I was an average to good sprinter, but because I was good at jumping, meant I was a fairly decent high hurdler. But the 1,500 metres, well, you just suffer. That's the point with that.
We've got to keep moving on. Meanwhile, at your church in Harlesden, new officers, new ministers appointed. along with their lovely daughter, which must have been a delight for you. And there she is, look, the lovely daughter,
yes.
Marlene. Was it love at first sight?
What, for her, you mean? yes, it was, actually. I did say to my friend who subsequently became my best man that I think I'm going to marry her, I said. And we hadn't even gone out on a date yet. So it was, I was pretty determined. And she
succumbed. And you did indeed marry. So the pictures to prove the happy couple.
Yes.
When was that?
That was 21st of March, 1970. And apparently, we only found out last weekend when we went to 125th anniversary reunion weekend at Harlesden. One of the people there told us that those pictures that you just saw stopped the traffic in Harlesden High Street. Mm-hmm. Because behind us is the Methodist Church, which is where we had our reception, and it's the main road. And a lot of people in funny uniforms and a lot of black people and a lot of white people coming together was not a very usual sight. So the traffic, there was a bit of a traffic jam, but we had no idea.
And that's the traditional outfit for a Salvation Army wedding, is it?
Well,
no
it's
white
a choice.
Dress and your
it's a choice, really. If you are Salvation Army officers, you would always get married in uniform back then. We were very, if you like, strong in the army. We were very committed, and we felt, let's get married in uniform. It had two very significant things, really. It meant that we saved money on our wedding outfits. And when I said two, mine and hers.
How did your relationship go down with both sets of parents?
Well, it was very straightforward for my parents, I think, in the sense that they had little expectation that I would be forming a relationship with anybody that was not in the Salvation Army. And back then, there were very few black people in the Salvation Army in the UK. You know, there were very few families. So they were not at all surprised. And they were used to white people being part of the social situation, both in Jamaica and here, far more so than the white English community were used to black people being part of their social environment. So I think that it took a while for Frank and Ivy, my erstwhile in-laws, to get used to the idea. But there was not a problem. They were just concerned that there might be challenges ahead that we needed to take account of. As indeed there were.
And then in 1974, your elder son, Matt's born. How was it received? I remember my mother, who sort of could come out with sort of little bits of casual racism every so often, saying, you know, it's the children I'm concerned for with a mixed race marriage. I mean, were you having to field things like that all the time?
Well, there were one or two things. I think that, first of all, just to be slightly pedantic, it would have been and is a mixed heritage marriage, of course, because there is only one race, just to remind you all, and that's the human race. There were some challenges, and we have two children. I don't know whether I'm stealing your next line, but our second son Daniel is learning disabled, and one of our friends, in inverted commas, a really good friend actually, but with little real understanding, said, well, of course, that's part of what happens when, or she didn't call it mixed heritage, but, you know, when a mixed heritage marriage happens, you know, that's what you can expect. In the cool light of day in 2018 seems fairly crass. However, you know, think back to 1974 or whenever, and some of the things that people understood or misunderstood. Very hurtful, very problematic, of course, quite damaging, potentially.
I remember you saying, in some ways, thought it was worse for Marlene than it was for you.
Yes, I mean, one of the things, of course, especially if you are a bit brash and quite big and male, you don't generally get people coming up to you and just saying racist things out of the blue or talking about those people in ways that are particularly negative. They might not like you, they might wish you were somewhere else, but it's rarely in your face. Whereas for Marlene, and I only really got my head around this after some years, she would be always in conversations where people were having their conversation, but without knowing who she was in relation to me, if I was not there. And so, you know, that was not always very straightforward, wasn't always easy. And I think even now, for people who are part of a mixed heritage relationship, or even somebody who might be in a gay relationship, are often faced with people making comments, having conversations, without, as it were, knowing who they are and who they're related to.
Going back to Daniel, your second son, when did you realize that there was something different, some disability?
Quite early on. I mean, apart from anything else, he had a cleft palate when he was born. He had extra digits. And in a sense, those were the obvious physical signs that there might be an issue, but there was no certainty that there was going to be an issue, other than, you know, there was... you know, bless him, he had to have a false plate from very early and lots of, you know, 2-hourly feeds with a false plate was not always straightforward, mainly for Marlene, I have to say, rather than just me. But after 18 months, it was clear to us, really, 18 months, a couple of years, that there was something not quite right for Daniel. His development was not going how we believed it should be. We had a few run-ins with the professionals who thought that we were comparing him with Matthew, who was a very bright, precocious child, walking at 9 months and talking quite early on, you know, telling us we didn't deserve him at 3 and that sort of thing. But we knew that there was something about Daniel that wasn't right. And it became clear that he was on the autistic spectrum. That much we began to discern after a few years. But it wasn't until he was well into his teens until there was a proper diagnosis.
And he's never spoken, is that correct?
No, he has no speech. And one of the things that Marlene did, was to learn what was then a new sign language called Makaton, and she taught that to his nursery school so that he could be able to be communicated with and could communicate himself more easily. And it transformed our lives, really, because it meant that we knew that he not only wanted a drink, but we knew that it was milk or orange juice or tea, rather than just having to trial and error all the time. So that was very powerful. And he uses Makaton now. He's a bit slapdash, as we all are with our spoken language. But it was transformational, really.
But you and Marlene, you're both Christians. What impact did this have on you and your faith? Did you find your faith in Jesus was a comfort in this, or were you just busy questioning why God should have allowed this, or maybe both?
Yeah, I mean, a bit of both, but I think that the why didn't go on for very long, because it was, you had to get on with dealing with it. You know, there are lots of things, aren't there, that you just haven't got time to worry about the why. You're just dealing with the what. So yes, you know, stuff happens is our philosophy, and stuff happens to people. I think after a while, we took up the position of being, well, you know, it has to happen to somebody. It might as well be us. Apart from anything else, we can handle this. So there was a sense of feeling that this was, it was what it was. I don't think we never felt that this was God's will that this should have happened, but rather that we would be enabled to deal with this as a consequence of, you know, the support and sense of love that we felt through Jesus. And so that continues. You know, Daniel, he taught us many, many things. I mean, I was, in my work, I was focused very much as a community worker on enabling people to be themselves. And the idea of labeling was something that I thought was bad. You know, you shouldn't give people labels. Within a couple of years of Daniel being born, we wanted a label, because we wanted to know what the condition was. Because without, you know, knowing, without having a diagnosis, you have no sense of the prognosis. You have no sense of how you can support, how you can cope with. So that was a very early lesson for us about Daniel.
You mentioned going into community work. How and why did you end up doing community development work?
Well, I think it goes back to, I mentioned Bill Daniel, my mentor and friend. He was the responsible for the Sunday school at the Salvation Army. He was a youth worker. He was literally larger than life. He was about 6'6". He'd been a circus clown. I don't think he needed those extended shoes. His feet were large enough. And Bill was very much a role model for me, and he helped me to work through what it was that I wanted to do and to be in my life. It was strange for some people that I should leave show business. I mean, when I left, it was from, you know, Hair. It was a hit West End musical which ran and ran and ran long after I had left. And so at the height of a very short career, I left, and the only reason I left was that wasn't what I was meant to do. And so I left to go and train to do community development. What is community development? That's a very good question. I think the easiest way to explain it is that if I was doing it in the developing world, it would be about roads and electricity and water. In the UK, community development is about enabling people to have other kinds of access. So how do you access the local authority? How do you get better at going on a 500,000 person march, as we saw last weekend or yesterday. It was about enabling people to create and develop their own local community services. And certainly when we look back from 2018, it's hard to think that back in the 70s and 80s, there weren't that many adventure playgrounds for children. There weren't mums and toddlers groups hadn't been invented. There were all sorts of things that we take very much for granted now that were started back in the late 70s. And that was all about community work, community engagement. And a lot of it was quite challenging. I do remember that I worked in Manchester for a while, and I had we got a group of residents who were concerned about walkways around their estate, our estate, because I was a resident community worker. And we had the one of the planners there to answer questions about why there was a block like this at the bus stop and then grass all around it to get to it. And we said, well, you know, how do we get to the... Why isn't there a path? And without any kind of sense of irony, he said, well, if the chief planner had wanted you to have a path, he'd have put one there. So we got a path. But, you know, so community, it could be as direct as that in terms of key facilities that that you want to support people in doing, or as basic as helping people to set up and run a mums and toddlers group or a parents and toddlers group, building community centres and so on. So a lot of this work now is done in a church environment. You know, churches have youth workers or community workers. And so that was the background, really.
And I'm particularly interested that you were in North Yorkshire, in Scarborough, sort of Yorkshire, my favourite hunting ground where I was brought up. But I imagine sort of North Yorkshire in the 70s, 80s?
72.
Was there wouldn't have been that many black faces. I remember talking to the local policeman in Nidderdale in North Yorkshire, and he was joking that he knew all the ethnic minority at the local school really well. It was his son, who was an adopted boy, but he was the only non-white kid in the whole comprehensive school,
yeah.
Nidderdale. That was probably in the 80s, but so he must have been a significant minority in North Yorkshire.
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, but I remember that when I was... I applied for the job, obviously, and the day before, I was to leave to go up for the interview a couple of days later. Somebody brought a Sunday paper to me. It was one of the... broadsheets, I can't remember, I think it's now out of print, but it was a story about the about Yorkshire and glorying in the wonders of old England, you know, the Yorkshire Dales, the moors, the rolling downs, the sea, the beaches, and not a black face in sight. And this was a national Sunday newspaper. Yeah. So that kind of gave me a bit of oomph. I thought, this job is mine. I need to get this job.
Imagine you could have had quite a bit of fun there, because it's a name like Mr. Spencer and a nice sort of received pronunciation, southern accent. Did you manage to confuse people?
Oh, yes, people were very confused, which was to my benefit and to the benefit of the communities that I worked in, really, because I would make the appointment, and I would... They thought Lindbert was a bit of a strange name, but that didn't throw them too much because of how I speak. And then I would arrive, and they would be so shocked, they would say yes to everything I asked for. So we did quite well, you know, out of that initial throwing back on their heels.
I remember when I ran a youth group in Leeds, there was the mum of one of the kids. I could not place her accent at all. It was really strange. Till she phoned me up, and it was pure Jamaican, but she was white, working class Jamaican, and I just... that fooled me. It's a... what you see and what you hear can sometimes contradict each other.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I recall that I worked at the Foreign Office for a number of years, and one of the programs that was run included a committee around the Caribbean trade. and there was a man who was a member of the Foot Clan, you know, I can't remember which
Michael Foot and Michael, people like that.
Yeah, one that group of people, but the Jamaican arm, and he was a white foot, as it were, and but he had a very strong Caribbean accent. And when we were both at meetings, people would think that we were just winding them up.
Excellent. Well, obviously, your time in Scarborough was much appreciated because they named a street after you, didn't they? And I think we've got... There it is, look, a picture.
Oh, you found it.
Spencer Way.
Oh, there you go, yes.
So what did that mean to you when they did
that?
Oh,
that was fabulous, and my grandkids loved it when they went up there because, of course, they're called Spencer, so they thought it was about them. but that was that's a throwback to the athletics because when I was in Scarborough, I was an athlete. And before the new estate was built, there was a kind of, not it wasn't even a road run because it was off-road, but there was a cross-country running path that I would take in my training. And they decided to name it Spencer Way. And one day a journalist called me, because they didn't tell me, from the Scarborough, the Yorkshire Evening Post, I think, and said, did you know that they were going to do this? I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And there it was, yeah, it's very humbling.
And on that happy note, we're going to take a break. We're going to have a 10-minute interval now, so stock up on refreshments, and back here in 10 minutes. Thank you very much.